favor.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. And it's Monday, March 20th. We've got several things on our agenda today. I'm not certain we'll get through all of it. And we won't be starting House Bill 2005 until 2 o'clock, at which point, wherever we are, I will probably stop and start working on that particular bill. But stay tuned. So I am going to start with the bill we carried over from last week, House Bill 2858. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2858.
Mr. Chair, committee members, just a reminder that this is the bill that establishes the process and timelines for DCBS to follow after they receive a complaint alleging a violation of the insurance code.
All right. So I have from last week, Mike Bybee, Doug Hartley, Betsy Earls to start with, or however you want to do it. Betsy, you can come up in the next panel if you want to. It doesn't matter.
I can be helpful and sit down right now.
I like it when you're helpful.
Right.
So.
Oh. Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'm Doug Hartley with Hartley Insurance in Silverton. I'm also going to be speaking for Mike Bybee, Stan Stewart Bybee in Portland. He's been in the business 30 years. I've been in 38 years, past president of the Oregon Professional Insurance Association of Oregon, Idaho. And opposition, we're speaking today on 2858. What we're trying to address here is currently in the property casualty business, personal lines rates are going quite a bit higher on autos. We feel this bill is going to increase claims costs, which will increase premiums. What we're running across now in the market is a personal auto, you've got distracted driving, so frequency is up, fatalities are up, you got more uninsured motorists. You're also having people drive more. The cost of gas is down, so they're driving more. And this is not just in Oregon, but across the country. So we're seeing here, Mike and myself and other agents, sitting across the board dealing with these rate increases. And now this bill looks like it will clog the system down, put it into the court systems, be able to sue twice. And we feel strongly that the insurance department here in Oregon does a good job. If an agent or a company is not performing properly, they're on top of it. They're on top of it. So we look at this as being a situation where if this goes through, increase the cost, agents like Mike and myself are sitting across there talking to these folks as they're seeing the auto rates go up, like I said, in Oregon, but also across the country for the based on those factors. And Mike and myself represent several preferred auto carriers. We're independent agents, and all of them are taking rate, and they have for several years. And talking to our friends at other companies that we don't represent, it's the same thing. It's across the board. So we are battling that with the consumer, with their budgets tight. Here's some increases. Well, if this is going to increase, and it will increase the claim costs, we're going to see that adjusting the rates down the road also. And our strong point is the director does a good job of taking care of the bad apples, agents, and the companies. And we just see kind of an added cost going on here. Mike's statement, he's up in Happy Valley, and he's got high-end individuals, and he's got ones that are in the poverty. Everybody's struggling. Their budgets are tight, and we hate to see another law go in effect such as this that would affect the rates down the road.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Appreciate
Chairman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association, and appearing before you in opposition to House Bill 2858. AOI and the business community does have a position paper on OLIS as well that you may want to refer to that shows a little bit more about our position and our supporters. The Oregon legislature has rejected second suit insurance litigation bills in good times in 2007, as well as in bad economic times in 2009 and 13. Legislators in those situations recognize that laws which encourage more lawsuits lead to higher insurance premiums for businesses, their customers, and their employees. And we ask that you continue to reject such legislation, as consumers are already well protected by current law. House Bill 2858 allows the filing of not one, but two lawsuits in disputes over claims. Under current law, Oregonians involved in an accident have the right to file a lawsuit over the personal injury claim at the core of the dispute, but 2858 would allow attorneys and their clients to file a second lawsuit against the insurance company for acting in bad faith. Lawsuits, insurance fraud, excessive payouts, and premiums all shot up when California experimented with the same second lawsuit or bad faith statutory scheme that you find in House Bill 2858. One example is auto premiums, which rose to 52% as a result. The courts and ultimately voters in California, by a 3-to-1 margin, stepped in to put an end to these lawsuits, which then dropped back down to prior levels after the second suit experiment ended. Oregon law already protects insurance buyers against breach of contract rights and provides attorney fees in successful cases. Our courts already recognize that a tort of bad faith for insurers who put their own interests above a customer's and punish insurers who fail to take proper steps to settle or defend claims. So as you consider 2858, please keep in mind that insurance companies are not ultimately the entities that cover the cost of increased lawsuits and increased payouts. Those who pay those premiums are the business community and private citizens who are paying for the insurance policies on their own. Those costs are passed directly through to us. So we encourage your opposition to 2858, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you for your input. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman.
Up next, Elise Brown and Roger Beyer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown, for the record, here representing America's Health Insurance Plans. AHIP is the National Trade Association of Health Plan Members across the country. And Betsy Earls just mentioned a letter that was submitted to you on OLIS that has a number of stakeholders signed on in opposition, and that includes some of my AHIP members. So I'm going to give you the health insurance perspective and why my Oregon members are here today in opposition. So as health plan members, AHIP members across the country, we work in a many different state regulatory environments. And Oregon has some of the strongest insurance regulation and consumer protection laws in the country. In fact, it's referred to as the gold standard. In 2013, stakeholders, including Paul Terdahl, came to consensus on the support of Senate Bill 414, which created a fast, free-of-charge dispute resolution and restitution program. You heard him go to a thorough summary of what that bill did, and let me tell you what's happened since the bill passed. In November of 2014, the Insurance Division issued guidance to insurers, my Oregon members, that they cannot categorically deny coverage of mental health treatments, including ABA, applied behavioral analysis, which is used to treat autism. You have that bulletin that's also submitted to you on OLIS with more background. Last year, the Department of Financial Regulation was formed after the merger of Insurance Division and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. What this did is create a new division that brings stronger enforcement presence and increased ability to take swift action to protect our Oregon consumers. So as recently as March 2nd, DCBS has issued proposed enforcement orders to four health insurance companies who violated laws regulating the coverage of mental health treatments. So my suggestion to all of you is that the Department of Financial Regulation has all the tools necessary. The system is working, and that's why we're here in opposition today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing both the Independent Agents and Brokers of Oregon and National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors in opposition to House Bill 2858. Much of what I would say has already been said by the people who spoke just in front of me, but I'd like to point out that for the insurance agent perspective is that most agents, if not all, get paid on commission. So whereas when rates go up, agents might make more money, that's against the best interest of our clients, and especially the lower income clients who can least afford insurance. So that's why they are opposed to this bill. Another thing, very troublesome part of this bill, is a piece in Section 4 which allows people to file claims within the insurance division about claims about violations they think will occur. And that's what it says in the bill. They report on violations or violations that may happen of insurance code. So virtually everyone who deals with insurance could be subject to this provision, because you never know. Someone might someday violate insurance code. So that provision is very troubling for the agents also. So with that, I'd also like to point to the, as you heard, 2013 law, Senate Bill 414, which allowed for compensation for bad practices. That's a key provision. It seems to be working well. So with that, unless there's any questions, I just urge you to oppose House Bill 2858.
So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Mike Bybee. I'm an independent agent, and sorry for being tardy. I had traffic to get through. My agency is located in Southeast Portland. My primary community that I serve is East Portland, Gresham, and Happy Valley area. And I've heard the prior testimony from Wednesday, so I won't speak to with regard to our current structure with the insurance commissioner and putting this in a court system. I really want to really talk about what Roger was saying with regards to the rates and the impact it's having on the community. My geographic area where I'm located is very economically diverse. We have a pretty healthy contingent of affluent individuals. We have an equally healthy contingent of people that are living at poverty level or pushing up against it. So I see both sides. In my case, in particular, and I'm sure some of you who live in the metro area can probably attest to this, I've had insurance premiums on my auto insurance increase close to 50% in the last 3 years, 15% a year. And the bad news is I represent 8 different insurers, and every company that's come in has said expect another 10 or 15 again. And I said, my gosh, what's pushing this? And their response was higher auto repair costs, higher fatality rate throughout the state, especially in the metropolitan area, higher significant injury accidents in the metropolitan area. Their belief system was inadequate infrastructure to carry the population density, distracted driving. And then the other thing that they were saying was higher uninsured motorist claims. And that's what I want to focus on, because when you're looking at a higher rate with the people who are on the lower economic stature, they're in this nasty cycle, because what happens is their credit scores are usually not the best, so they're getting penalized a little bit more. So now the rates go up. Now they're under financial pressure. How do I make these payments? Of course, one of the things that they'll do is they'll let the policy go. Well, now, because of the way the current structure is, now it's like double jeopardy to get back in the game, because they have a non-continuous policy period, a lapse in coverage, and they have a bad credit score. And so it's this constant evolution of a bad cycle that is just, it's hard to get off the hamster wheel, so to speak. Needless to say, that would testify why we have a higher incident of uninsured motorist claims. So every policy that we put here and say, okay, we should do this, and that's putting pressure on the premium, is causing basically, in my mind, a social crisis from the auto insurance side, because that gap is going to continue to go like this. So that's really all I had to say.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Questions from this panel? Appreciate your testimony today.
Do you have any more coming?
Yes, I do. Bill Perry. And Barbara Zachary. Zachary Flapper. Oh, that's okay. Don't sit very close to him and you'll be fine.
Okay. What happened to my rounding points from the other day?
I forgot them over the weekend, or ate them, one of the two. So.
You want to go first, or you want me to?
Go ahead, Bill.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I just wanted to touch on two points that I don't think were covered yet. First of all, I know this bill that's been introduced in the past sometimes has excluded workers' compensation. Now, the workers' compensation, as we most of us know, years ago they had exclusive remedy was a main underpinning to lower rates. And so this it would change that, and so there would be multiple remedies for that. Also, in our industry, is I think what I heard the presenters on this bill talk about is they would thumb through the records of incidents. And in the restaurant industry, we tend not to have big incidents, but we have lots of little incidents. So if they're looking for patterns or different things like that, it's going to expose our industry probably more than others. We have a lot of cuts, slips and falls, different things like that. The other thing that would be unique to our industry is we have mandatory liquor liability in this state for all liquor licensees. What happens when you have increased exposures is you get a lot of the carriers to leave the market because obviously there's high liability in liquor liability insurance. So those in different times, like in the 90s and early 2000s, when you've had increased exposures, you have like sometimes a 300% in premiums because when carriers leave the market and there's fewer carriers, obviously those rates go up. So for those two specific reasons, I think this would have a bigger impact on our industry in some fashion. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Would you go ahead and provide us your testimony if you'd identify yourself for the record?
Hello, my name is Barbara Hafer, and I live in North Portland. I have a 12-year-old son. His name is Lucas. And he is, I'm sorry, kind of nervous. He is a nonverbal classic autistic. He also has sensory processing disorder. I come to you because when he was diagnosed, my son, sorry, this is hard, had self-injurious behavior. He would pinch his skin. He would take his fists and lay down and drop his fist on his face. And this was starting at the age of two. He would drop a dead drop off of furniture, closing his eyes, really sensory seeking behaviors. He would, we'd have to watch the stove because he wanted to get the heat. We had to turn off the water in our house because he wanted to scald or freeze himself. He also had a tendency to elope, so we had to adjust our locks and things like that. He was diagnosed, of course, as I said, when he was two. It was recommended to us on the initial diagnosis that we take him to occupational therapy. We did. It was amazing. It was a miracle. I don't think you realize how amazing it can be, but within an hour of receiving this therapy, it's proprioceptive and vestibular senses, as well as the inability to deal with the sensory environment, was causing him to have these self-injurious behaviors. This was in about 2007. At the time, they only gave him 11 lifetime visits. And so we were naive at the time. We knew it said he had 11 lifetime visits, but, I mean, he wasn't hurting himself. He was actually doing something besides trying to do that. And so we just thought they would cover it. And so they didn't. They didn't cover it. And so me and my husband, you know, we make medium wage. I'm a college-educated student, you know, but we are median family. The cost $140 a week, and it climbed over the years to about $180, I think is what it was. So the rate that he was and the severity that he was, he had to go every week. And if he didn't, you could see him slide into the self-injurious behavior. We couldn't afford to go every week. They did pass the mental health parity law in Oregon, as well as the federal law, 2007, and I think in 2009, where they were supposed to cover these therapies, and they didn't. And we didn't understand. We appealed it. We were denied what they would tell us at first. They told us it was because he had autism. And then as the law changed, you could tell how the law was changing. Then it was denied because he had a developmental disorder. Then it was denied because it was educational for some reason. I don't know why. I mean, you don't tell somebody with a heart attack is hard educational. I don't know why this was educational. I still don't get that one. There was because it was habilitative and not rehabilitative. At one point, they told us it was a comfort as opposed to a medical necessity for him to not receive this treatment. My husband was laid off around 2008, 2009 because of the recession. Our appeals were denied. It would come in the back with a letter telling us that we had the right to appeal again, but it said if we talked to anybody outside of our family or anybody other than an attorney, that we could lose whatever services we did have that they covered for him. We didn't know what that could be. He had autism, and he wasn't allowed to get speech. He wasn't allowed to get ABA. He wasn't allowed to get OT. And we had to do it. It's either that or watch your kid hurt himself. And why? Why? I mean, they tell you that there's laws in the books that we're supposed to make them cover it. They didn't. They just didn't. And I can tell you there were many nights where I watched my son. When he went to sleep, he used to lay down and he'd, you know, drop his fist on me and on himself. And I had to let him do that because if I didn't, he would get more tired and get more upset and it would be worse. And this therapy that he had, it was just so helpful. It was so helpful. I mean, it meant the world. And it just, for them, it had to have been small. I mean, my husband takes a pill for his arthritis. That's $1,300 a month. And so, or $140 or whatever the rate was, they wouldn't do it. And so I understand that there's laws in the books, and I understand that they say that that's all the protection they need, but I'm sorry, that's a lie. I had to watch my son hurt himself, and they knew it. The doctors and the therapists and the speech therapists told us that they were amazed at how successful this was in treating him, and they just didn't care. They just would deny it. And so I know the doctors would tell me, you know, it's not going to be any use, we've never seen anybody get this treatment approved. They would talk to the speech therapist. He had an argument with me once he had like 12 visits or something like that before they cut it off, because they said it was educational. And I was not meaning to argue with them, but I work in a billing department, so I'm used to not bullied. And so he wanted to know why I was forcing insurers to pay for something that educational people were thought it was supposed to be found in school. Well, never mind the fact that he wasn't even in school. And honestly, if your child isn't speaking, I'm sorry, you don't go and ask the principal to diagnose your kid. You go to a doctor, right? So I'm sorry, I guess I should wrap it up. I don't know what else to say. We did everything that we thought we could. Everybody in the clinics told us it was futile. Every attempt that we ever made was futile. We had everything to gain by pursuing it as hard as we could. I had to refinance. I had to take out another loan just a few years ago to wrap up another credit card that I had to take out. And it was wrong. My kid should have had these services. And instead, he spent the first few years, especially of his life, just trying to get through the day. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. I think it was one of the main reasons this bill came forward were issues like that that people thought were covered by their insurance and ends up the insurance doesn't cover it for whatever reason. So appreciate your testimony. Is there questions? I see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Barenberg.
I'm sorry.
In committee, I did have a conversation with the workers' comp, and I'm aware of the issue that workers' comp has with the bill. I don't think they were intended to be included in this to start with, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg from Safe Corporation, and the chair just presented my testimony and did a better job than I. So I just wanted to raise the issue of exclusive remedy and workers' comp, and we've been in contact with the proponents of the bill and the drafter of the legislative concept and told that it wasn't their intent to include workers' comp. Sometimes we're the Rodney Dangerfield of issues that, you know, that we get included in things just because we're under the insurance definition, but the system works very, very differently. And thank the chair and thank the proponents for understanding the issue once presented. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So I've had a request, Jeanette Holman and Rick Blackwell. And for the committee's information, Jeanette Holman is one of the proponents of the bill who can answer questions. And, of course, Mr. Tapman can come along if he's not just observing today.
Thank you.
And Rick Blackwell's from Department of Consumer and Business Services working with the Insurance Division. And I'm sure they're not here to advocate for or against the bill, but for to answer questions, and I think some people had questions. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I mean, as we hear testimony here of added costs, doubling up on the work, not one but two lawsuits, financial regulations, policy is going to increase the cost to a lot of people. I'm just wondering, this bill, how it affects your investigations of violations. I mean, for the added cost that is being presented here, how advantageous to you is this bill?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Barreto, for the record, my name is David Tapman. I'm the Chief of Enforcement for the Division of Financial Regulation. That means I oversee a staff of investigators and enforcement officers that serve in a legal capacity. And we work for the entire division, not just insurance, but the vast bulk of what we do tends to be around insurance. And so last year we had over 330 actions that we took against various companies and individuals. That's legal actions, administrative actions. We had more than that number of investigations. And that's both insurance and non-insurance, or the financial side of things. We had 225 or so insurance-related actions that we took. This bill, if implemented, in my opinion, would mandate that we have to take steps to enforce every complaint that came in. And that's not, or if you will, investigate. If we have to investigate every complaint, we don't have the discretion to exercise what's valid and what isn't in the insurance region. But more importantly, that means that we wouldn't have sufficient staffing to do the rest of what we've been charged by the legislature. So I say we investigate, whether it's banking or consumer, finance or securities or mortgage brokers. All those are done under this one the auspices of this one agency. The impact would require us to expand our staff considerably. And, of course, there's concomitant costs when we have to expand our staff. So that would be the direct impact of the bill becoming law.
Mr. Chair, if I may add, and Vice Chair Barreto, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, the Policy Manager of the Division of Financial Regulation. For context, in 2016, we received about 4,000 formal complaints that came in through our consumer advocates. So that's kind of where we're at in terms of scope.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
What does it mean to increase staff considerably? What the number of people that you were thinking of adding on, how many is that? Or how many would you need?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Barreto, I have not prepared a fiscal impact statement for that, so I couldn't give you a hard number. But if we use 4,000 as the number, and each one of those has to result in an investigation, you could imagine that be considerable. As I said, we did 330 formal actions last year, and so 4,000 is 10 times that plus.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So when you say that you did 300 and some, do you feel that you adequately, out of the 4,000, investigated the cases that you needed to, or are you saying that you only had the manpower to do that, or were those cases that you feel like actually needed to be investigated?
Well, I'll just talk about discretion. Mr. Chair and Representative Hack, so what we're really talking about is discretion, and this bill takes that away. And we have to be able to exercise discretion as a regulatory agency. I don't believe there's a regulatory agency anywhere that doesn't exercise discretion, and that's true for law enforcement as well. Those 4,000 came in as consumer complaints. We have an advocacy team that handles all those complaints. Every phone call, every written complaint goes to somebody in the consumer advocacy. Most of them are resolved there. Now, some aren't resolved to somebody's satisfaction, but many of them are. And there's $1.3 million that was recovered through that consumer advocacy group. So in my personal opinion, I think that is successful. But in addition to that, if we had to take all 4,000 of those and then treat that as an investigation, we'd be, A, duplicating our efforts, and, B, we wouldn't necessarily result in us taking a formal enforcement action beyond what we did. But the law is written so that it would require us to take some enforcement steps to investigate. Right now, we don't investigate the vast majority of those 4,000. It's only when we get a referral from consumer advocacy or other parts of the division that we will then investigate.
And Chair Holvey, Representative Hack, if I may build on what David Tapman had said, 97% of the complaints, the 4,000 that went into our consumer advocacy unit, were resolved informally. Folks got their coverage or understood kind of their rights and responsibilities under the code. The remaining 130 were assigned out to other areas of the division. So our colleagues in compliance that run examinations or enforcement.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I guess that brings up a question for me. Assuming that this bill gave you the discretion that you have now, I mean, what happens to the consumers that do have a complaint and it's a real one? And I mean, I think the sponsor of this bill described, you know, that I can't remember, the insurance company was actually found that they were supposed to be providing this benefit, yet 6 years later, there's still no resolution to it, and he doesn't have the benefit. He's out time, he's out money, he potentially has attorney cost. He can't recover any of that, even if, in my understanding of the law, or can he? And even assuming that you found that the insurance company didn't follow the law and you didn't sanction them in this case, or you could sanction them, but still, does it ever provide that recovery for the consumer?
Mr. Chair, that's a loaded question. You have a number of facets to it that I'll try and peel back. So one at a time. One, he is authorized, in fact, is legally has the authority to seek his attorney's fees. And as you heard from one of the prior witnesses that came up here, our agency took action just in March in the process of issuing notice that we want to resolve some issues. And one of those very issues was around a carrier who had not done properly in terms of providing notification that people have that right to collect attorney's fees if they go through a legal dispute. So that does exist. So he does have the right to recover that. But again, I don't want to get into the facts of it because, one, I'm not as well informed as he is. But, two, there's probably nuances that we don't understand why he has or hasn't received his attorney's fees. And they're still litigating that. So that's part of the process. As Mr. Blackwell said, in most instances, we are able to help the advocate, the people who turn to our consumer advocates. And we've had a number of complaints around mental health parity, and we'll address those. And we'd like to think that we have made a great strides in that area. As you heard earlier, it wasn't until 2014 that the division made the determination that ABA, the behavioral analysis therapy, was something that should be provided. And so up until that time, it was a question that hadn't been resolved. And so going forward, we've been addressing that, and we have addressed those issues on behalf of consumers. We've done a number of calls. We call them data calls, where we get information from all the carriers, trying to determine how they're doing in terms of the number of cases that have been filed and the number of cases that have been complained about, number of claims that have been filed, and how they've been handled. We have the authority to appoint somebody as an independent review organization. That allows the consumer to go and say, I believe you mishandled this to the insurance company, and then have it independently reviewed. We've been very clear, if the independent review organization, the IROs, consistently find that people are not complying with the law, we will step in and take action. And as earlier mentioned, we've taken action in three other cases where we've initiated an attempt to resolve our concerns about this particular area. And so I think there are remedies there. There are times where the contract's going to be disputed, and the individual has the right to sue on the contract and seek recovery against that contract. And I believe the case you just mentioned, in the case of Mr. Trudell, he is suing on his contract with his carrier, and they're in litigation.
All right. I guess since, would you care to comment?
Just a couple of comments, first of all.
You could identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm a citizen, and I have been working with Autism Speaks and Oregon Autism Society and Paul Trudell on these bills. A couple of things. The intent of this bill was not to add a lot of burdensome additional process. The problems were the 5.5 years of waiting for something to be done, or the 6 years waiting for something to be done. And the we had been through the processes with the Uniform Trade Practices Act, and there are problems with taking that approach. So we tried to design an approach that kept everything within the division and that didn't disrupt that process of consumer complaints. It is not intended that every consumer complaint that goes through the consumer advocacy process has to have a full-blown process. In fact, our intent was that because that is such a successful process, those claims or those complaints should continue to happen just like they do now. The problem is the crosswalk between that process and an enforcement process. And the consumer is usually left out of that process. And this bill was an attempt to remedy that, to provide a crosswalk between the consumer advocacy process and the investigation process and ultimately enforcement, to keep that consumer involved if possible. What the bill does is put a 1-year limit on how long the division would have to act, and then at the end of that 1 year, the insurance division, the new Division of Financial Regulation, can either ask the consumer for additional time to resolve that, or issue an order or a decision that they can't resolve it within the time period. At that point, the consumer has 90 days to file action for a private right of action. So they're not, they're kind of connected, but there are some limitations on what the consumer can do to get there. It's to avoid leaving the consumer without a remedy, and that's what this bill is intended to do, and to set up a structure for that enforcement process. It's pretty loose right now, and it took me quite a while to understand what this bill did after I we got it back from Legislative Council. And what has happened is Legislative Council has repealed all of the existing, in this bill, repealed the existing enforcement mechanisms and replaced them with the what we sent them, but with some, much of this is the same process that's there now, but it's spelled out in more detail.
So I'm just, if you can clarify one thing, because I'm hearing that the consumer has a private right of action already, or can, you know, take the insurance company to suit over the contract.
Correct.
But how does, I mean, how does that differ than what you're describing?
Well, what the bill does not limit it to just the contractual terms. A lot of times the claim will be turned down because it's not in your contract or it's not part of the contract or outside of the contract. But other things happen that to a consumer that results in them not getting a claim paid.
Oh, I see. Okay. And so you also mentioned the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So how does that play into this discussion? I wasn't aware that there was a pathway to that.
There isn't.
Mr. Chair, there's no pathway right now. Insurance is excluded from the UTPA, Unlawful Trade Practices Act. I believe this body at some point reviewed that concept, what, 2 or 4 years ago?
It seemed like every year I was at the insurance division. But yeah, this bill does not change that. It does not bring the insurance into the UTPA.
Okay. All right. Thank you for coming up. I don't see any other questions for you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2858. And let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2567. Jan, could you give us a brief summary?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill is, chief sponsor is Representative Witt, requires employers with 75 or more employees to provide at least 60 days notice to the employees and government officials before ceasing operations, relocating, or laying off 50 or more employees. Requires the employer to provide documentation to the court or the BOLI when invoking an exception that involves active pursuit of capital or business, provides private right of action, and holds the employer liable for back pay, benefits, and compensatory damages. There are no amendments today.
Thank you. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31. Appearing before you as the chief sponsor of House Bill 2567. With me this afternoon is Megan Baumhart, who is an intern in my office and has done a considerable amount of research on this bill. House Bill 2567 is an attempt to create a Little Warren Act in the state of Oregon, patterned after the Federal Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification, or WARN Act. Before I proceed, the first question out of the gate may be, well, we already have this covered by federal law. Why do we need state duplication? The problem arises in that there is a loophole in the definition in the Federal Act that under some circumstances where bankruptcy is declared, federal courts have ruled that no advance notice is necessary. Quite simply, bankruptcy occurs. At the point the gavel comes down on the bankruptcy, the individuals are no longer considered employees and therefore not subject to the act. The act cannot be invoked. So there are many instances the notice is currently not available to many employees. Like the federal act, House Bill 2567 would create a private sector employer obligation to give 2 months advance notice in the event of a mass layoff, which would be 50 or more employees laid off, relocation of the private sector operation, which would be is defined as 100 or more miles away from current location, or the termination of the operation. Failure to provide the 60-day notice would then, under the bill, obligate the employer to pay back pay, the equivalent amount of what benefits would have been lost, as well as compensatory damages, and lastly, attorney's fees. The notice would be required to go out to affected employees, the State Employment Department, the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department, so that they could undertake worker adjustment, and then the city and county where the layoff would occur. Under the bill, WARN notice is unnecessary in the instances of a natural disaster, a catastrophe, an employer who is actively seeking either capital and or expansion of the business at the time of the closure, relocation, or termination. A limited duration project where an employee would be hired strictly for the duration of a known project. And lastly, seasonal or temporary work. The purpose behind this and why I'm putting this bill forward is to give employees an opportunity to receive two months notice so that they can go through the necessary readjustments, hopefully in their personal lives, without ending up hopefully being able to avoid unemployment. I will tell you straight out that I believe that in several instances in this bill, it is the way currently written unnecessarily punitive. And I will be, Mr. Chairman, asking the committee's permission to move forward with several amendments. Number one, the bill was intended to reflect federal law. The threshold in as written is 75 employees. It would be my recommendation that the bill be amended to reflect the 100 employee threshold of the federal act. Number two, compensatory damages. I think that by any stretch of the imagination, a $500 per day fine is excessive, and I think that something that would be more in line with does the punishment fit the crime, so to speak, perhaps the equivalent of a day's wages would be more than sufficient. And then lastly, attorney's fees. I recognize that there are various ways to enforce this kind of legislation, and I am eager to work with Associated Oregon Industries and others to find a way to enforce the penalties without incurring unnecessary and overly harsh penalties. That may be enforcement through BOLI that they pursue on behalf of the employee or other methods to be determined. But right now, the meter keeps running. Again, the purpose of the bill is to provide an incentive for employers to give employees 2 months advance notice of severe economic change. That's the spirit in which I intend to proceed on this bill. And with your permission, I would like to give just a couple of minutes to Megan for her to explain the side-by-side comparison that she has done with a federal act and the proposed state legislation.
Representatives, my name's Megan Baumhart, intern to Representative Witt. And in front of you, I believe you have a table that our office made up that's the side-by-side comparison to the Warren Act and House Bill 2567. Many of these items our representative has already touched upon, but I will continue to go over them. The definition of an employer is changed from the Warren Act to House Bill 2567. Under the Warren Act, an employer is anybody that has 100 employees or 100 aggregated employees that total 4,000 work hours per week. Under House Bill 2567, it's only 75 employees. Another change between the two acts is the mass layoff definition. Under the Warren Act, a mass layoff constitutes either 33% of employees having to amount to 50 employees or over 5,000 employees. Under House Bill 2567, it's 50 employees. Another change is the employee compensation in the event of improper notification. There's a wording change that we felt should be highlighted. In the Warren Act, it's stated that the employee will receive final regular rate of compensation. In our House Bill 2567, its employee shall receive final rate of compensation minus the regular. And then finally, as we've already touched upon, is the court decisions. The Warren Act does not state of anything that the attorney fee shall be covered, as opposed to our House Bill 2567, that the court shall award reasonable attorney fees to the prevailing plaintiff. And then on the rightmost column, there is the section and item number, as well as the page and line number, if you'd like to look those up yourself.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony. Questions? Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, thank you for bringing this legislation before the committee. I came in late. Did I catch you saying that seasonal work was exempt?
That's correct. Under the bill, it is exempt.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to sort out when an employer pays into the unemployment insurance fund, both from a state perspective and federally, those funds are used to help with wage continuation, not fully, obviously, for employees. And that's only invoked when the employer formally lays off the employee. But then there's another period prior to the layoff that there's another fund. Can you explain how that fund would work in conjunction with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bynum, I'm not sure I know what that other fund is. I would say that this bill is an attempt to avoid the layoff, if at all possible, to give that employee 2 months while they are presumably employed or alternatively receiving benefits under this bill. To go out and find another job. It may be that there is a closure. It may be that there's a relocation. Whatever the circumstances are for that employee, then, to get ahead of the curve with a benefit of 60 days and try and find another job before the unemployment actually occurs.
Representative Barreto. Question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, A lot of times when we bring bills forward, they're because of a certain situation that's happened in the past. Has something happened in your district that you're familiar with that brought this bill forward?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barreto, yes. And it is the specifics that I mentioned that under the federal act, the employer's obligation to give the 2 months' notice may be relieved in an instance of declaring bankruptcy. As a former union representative, I have experienced a number of employees who were not covered by the act. As it turns out, their employer was actually employers were in most instances good to work with and worked with us to provide that notice, but there was no obligation, and there was, I can tell you, a great deal of uncertainty by all parties concerned whether or not the folks were going to be able to avail themselves of the worker readjustment activities.
Okay, kind of a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So when we experienced this recession in 2009, we laid off about 60 people at our place of business. And, you know, we just kept hanging on, you know, hoping, not knowing. First of all, we didn't want to lose any of our crew. It had taken us a long time to put them together. But as time went on, it became obvious that we could not continue to go this route. Sales were dropping and weren't coming back. And so it wasn't like no one knew, you know, what was going on in the business. And yet at the same time, we hadn't hung out there a definite date that we were going to start laying off. But it seemed imminent. So in the real world of business, when you hit a recession like that, and especially a big one like in 09, they come on pretty fast. And even though, and if we would have said, hey, if this thing doesn't pick up, we're going to be laying off in 2 months, which we probably did. But nevertheless, if people start leaving to go find other work if it's available, and then you start picking up, then you lose those quality employees. And so, I mean, we were real open with ours, but I could understand, too, from another standpoint, that you don't really want to lose these valued employees to go running off to another job if the economy's going to come back and it was just a temporary issue. So I do have some concerns with this. And like Representative Bynum said, they are covered by unemployment for a period of time. I think they lose about 2 weeks in between the being laid off and start receiving unemployment, but they are covered in that regard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barreto, actually in this instance, you would have been obligated to go through the very same procedure under the federal act. So this state legislation or this proposed bill would have changed nothing. The circumstances are virtually identical under both.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and for bringing the bill forward. I'm going to go ahead and try to finish this bill up. There's two people left to testify on it before we get into another bill. So Stacy Cowan and Betsy Earls.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, again representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. And all I wanted to put on the record, I think, that's pertinent for today is that we appreciate Representative Witt's willingness to work with us on 2570-6776 and have a couple of suggestions for him, and we will work with him offline to put those together. So thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Stacy Cowan with SEIU, Local 503. SEIU has 65,000 members statewide, both with the state of Oregon, and SEIU members work both in the public sector as well as in the private sector. SEIU 49 has 400 workers who work in large manufacturing plants and thousands of workers who work for large multinational companies, and we're strongly in support of House Bill 2567. I did submit some testimony to to OLIS, so I'll go ahead and be brief. Working families in Oregon are living in increasingly precarious conditions, and a sudden layoff can come as a particularly hard blow to families. When work disappears, that can mean a family is unable to cover the cost of basics like food and housing, clothing, health care. People experiencing homelessness in Oregon often report that a layoff is, in fact, what actually put them on the streets. These mass layoffs can also have a devastating effect on local communities. When hundreds of workers in a given area are laid off, the impact to local school, county, and city budgets is also felt. I won't repeat the points that the representative outlined, but I will just say that having 60 days to prepare for such a traumatic life change would mean families would have time to transition. We believe that the exceptions in the bill pertaining to seasonal workers as well as project-based workers really make the bill a reasonable mix for both the employee and the employer. Again, we'll just go ahead and leave it that. Thank you for the representative for proposing the legislation.
Thank you. No questions. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
One second.
Oh.
I just had a follow-up.
You have a question? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I was referring to was the Wage Security Fund. So I'll submit, if it's possible, submit that for the record for what we're talking about.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2567. And we'll stand at ease for just a few minutes.
Microphone's off. For ease.
I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2005. Jan, can you remind us where we're at?
The committee heard this measure February 22nd and March 13th. This is the measure, of course, that puts in place pay equity provisions. On the second hearing, the Dash 5 amendment was described. Would you like a quick...
you could give us a quick just high point.
High points applies pay equity provisions to people with disabilities. This is how it differs from the original version of the bill. And allows the employer to consider compensation of their current employee during a transfer, a move, or a hire. In other words, an internal employee. And it amends out any changes to OFLA or the Oregon Sick Leave Act.
All right. And Representative Hack.
Do you want me to make my...
Like to make a motion?
Yes. Chair Holvey, I move that we adopt the Dash 18 amendments to House Bill 2005.
Representative Hack moves that we adopt the Dash 18 amendments to House Bill 2005. And is there discussion? I will start the discussion by asking Betsy Earls to come up and describe the Dash 18. Did I say that right?
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. I think probably the place to start with the conversation about the Dash 18s is the Dash 5s, because these amendments were built on top of the Dash 5s, not on the base bill. And Representative Leininger talked with you about the Dash 5s last week, I think. So we just make a few changes that would be that would make this legislation easier for the business community to deal with in the Dash 18s. I think probably most notable is that we leave in all of the protected classes that are in the original bill and in as well as the addition of disability in the Dash 5s, in the Dash 18s. So we're not making any changes to the protected classes. We are also leaving in the prohibition on screening job applicants based on their current or past compensation or looking for salary history of an applicant or employee from a current or former employer before offering a job. We have added a couple of things to the defenses for a pay differential, in the section on page 4 in this bill, there's a series of things that an employer can base a pay differential on, and we added in the geographic location of the job as well as required travel for an employee. Those, I think, are both important, and geographic location of the job is particularly important since this body adopted the minimum wage bill last session that has the different geographic locations and wage based on that. And I know that the proponents talked about how geographic location would fit into the bona fide business necessity exception, but it makes the business community more comfortable to have that called out, honestly, in statute. I think probably the big piece for us is that in the, well, there's two big pieces. We remove the punitive damages section in the bill within our Dash 18 amendments, leaving other compensatory damages and other penalties as they are in current law for wage and hour and discrimination cases. The other piece that is very important to us and is frankly included in the Massachusetts law, which employers and the business community supported and which had bipartisan support, is the inclusion of an affirmative defense, and you see that on page 5. The bill or the amendments provide an affirmative defense for employers that have conducted a self-audit or self-evaluation of their pay equity practices in the last 3 years and that are making good progress on fixing any disparities in wages within their workplace. So I think, you know, especially based on the fact that the employer community in Massachusetts has had a very good experience working with this law and that they supported it as it passed, we feel like the affirmative defense goes a long way toward making this law a more bipartisan solution than the Dash 5s on their own.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Fahey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is about the self-evaluation affirmative defense piece of this. I've been a human resources consultant for about 16 years now. And I don't know that I've ever worked with any companies who keep data on their employees' sexual orientation, religion, disability status. So my question is just if you could talk a little bit about how it would work for an employer to conduct a self-evaluation that would identify possible pay discrepancies without having the employee-level data on those factors.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Fahey, you're absolutely right. That is a big problem for us in this bill. Those including those particular categories in the bill, just because those are things that an employer is not supposed to ask about necessarily or keep track of. It will make it more difficult, but it was pretty clear when we worked with members of both caucuses in this body that those were important categories to keep in into the bill. So, you know, I think perhaps there could be a little bit more work on the affirmative defense or the ways employers would deal with it. But I absolutely agree with you. It's going to be very hard to deal with that one way or another, affirmative defense or no affirmative defense, because employers aren't specifically allowed or particularly not allowed to keep track of those things or ask about them. So it makes it very difficult not to discriminate based on that if an employer doesn't necessarily know what those preferences or categories are. There are a lot of hard things about this bill. For everybody.
So also, I just had a question. I know that there was this section of that was based on the federal court decision on the Lilly Ledbetter case that I don't think is in the 18th, just from my quick little purview, that may have come out of the bill as well.
Mr. Chair, I believe that that's correct, and I apologize for failing to mention that. We have worked through a couple of iterations of this.
Right.
What the chair is referring to is the part that the part of the bill that requires this, that allows a separate cause of action for every paycheck, that says every separate paycheck is a separate discriminatory act, basically, and that is out of the Dash 18s. Yes.
So currently, that's the federal law for discrimination against women, I believe. Is that
correct? That's correct, Mr. Chair. But doesn't apply to other protected classes.
Right. Okay. Any other questions? Uh, Not seeing. Yes. Oh, Representative Kinnamer.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I guess so the major changes between where we are with that bill and this amendment, have you highlighted those or are there others as well?
Well, I think where we are in the base bill in this amendment.
Well, there's, I guess that's part of my, I'm sorry.
Sure, no,
that's part of my confusion, too, is I'm not sure what is currently on the floor in terms of the base bill, because there have been a lot of different amendments. And your set, this set of amendments is a response to those others. And so I'm trying to understand what specifically this addresses and changes from the last, I guess probably iteration, although I don't think that last iteration has been discussed in this body yet.
The dash five, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, yeah, the dash fives are the last we've discussed, but there are other iterations post dash five.
Correct. There are. We have the dash five that we've talked about in the committee, and we have now the dash 18 that Representative Hacks made the motion on, which is what we're discussing right now, how it compares to the
dash five.
To the
and
dash
so that's
five.
The what's, summary what's different. We've had.
So that's the summary we've got at this point.
Okay. Thank
you.
Okay. I guess then I'm okay. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah, I think we had the first hearing on the bill February 22nd.
And then March 13th, March 13th is when the dash five was discussed.
Was discussed, right. So, and we also there was another piece in this dash 18. I apologize because it just came out. So we're really, you know, just scrambling to understand it. But it seems that it also, there was a little piece that prevented the employer from reducing somebody's wage to gain equity as opposed to giving somebody a raise, and that piece seems to be changed as well.
That, can I cue in on that one? Chair, that was that's an LC omission. That was not actually part of the amendment. That was a miss on their part.
Oh, was that the last amendment, not this one?
Yeah, that was a miss. They just didn't get that put back in, but that was actually not part of this amendment.
Apologies for not seeing that. I just got these as well.
All right. Any other discussion on the dash 18? We have a motion on the table for adopting the dash 18 to House Bill 2005. Not seeing any other discussion. Kayla, can we have a roll call vote on the dash 18 amendment?
Representative Gordy?
No.
Representative Evans?
With respect, no.
Representative Fahey?
No.
Representative Hack?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
No.
Chair Holby?
No. So the dash of 18 amendment fails.
Chair, I move to adopt the dash 5 amendment.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2005. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call vote on the dash 5 amendment?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
No.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Kinnamer?
No.
Vice Chair Barreto?
No.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Yes.
Chair Holby?
Aye. The dash 5 amendments haven't received the required votes is passed. And
Chair.
Has it been scheduled yet?
Probably let the bill think so. You're going to move as amended, is that right?
Okay, that's where I was going.
So maybe wait there. One step.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry.
I knew where you were going.
I knew where she was going.
I know your point. So Representative Bynum, have moved the bill as amended. Just move to adopt. Move.
Keep going down.
Right here.
Chair Holvey, I move the House Bill 2005 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the House Bill 2005 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? And Jan, as I recall, the fiscal impact statements in was indeterminate, and revenue impact statement.
There's a fiscal impact statement that is stating that it's indeterminate. It's posted on OLIS, and the revenue is either no revenue or minimal. If you just give me a second, revenue. There's no revenue impact.
Thank you. So the motion on the tables to move the House Bill 2005 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And Kayla, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Is there any discussion?
Oh, is there any more discussion? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to put on the record that I still do believe that there is a potential for a fiscal based on the steps and based on the fact that we I have concerns whether or not the private sector is the only one that has an issue with pay equity and whether or not that this will affect our cities, counties, and our state. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment. There is always debate when there's an indeterminate fiscal on whether or not there will be one or not. It's sometimes hard to tell. I did look at the bill as well and note that a lot of these cases can already be filed just in a different venue. And the bill does provide quite a bit of clarity as well as to what is discrimination. So it could be helpful to employers to know exactly what those issues are. So, yes, it is difficult to know. But thank you. Kayla, could we have that roll call vote now, please?
Representative
Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative
Fahey?
Aye.
Representative
Pack?
No.
Representative Kinnemer?
No.
Vice Chair Barreto?
No.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2005, having received the required votes, is passed, and we will have Representative Leininger, I'll carry that bill on the floor. That'll close the work session on House Bill 2005. And we will open a public.
Chair.
Oh,
sorry.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to serve notice that there's a potential of a minority report to be filed on House Bill 2005.
So noted.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3060.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is a measure that requires every public contract to include as a material term that the contractor certifies that they have a policy and practice to prevent sexual harassment, sexual assault, and discrimination against members of protected classes. Prohibits the state contracting agency from entering into a public contract with anticipated price exceeding $150,000 with any contractor that's not certified in writing that they have such a policy in practice. Becomes operative January 1, 2018, then takes effect 91 days following signee die. There's a -2 amendment from Representative Leininger. I don't know if you want her to cover that or.
Why don't we go ahead and have Representative Leininger and Representative Alonzo León. And just so you know in the audience, we will not be getting to House Bill 2671 nor House Bill 3184 today. We will carry them over to Wednesday. Remind me of that. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 3060. I know there are a number of people in the audience who are here to testify in support as well, so I will keep my remarks brief. This bill is intended to prevent workplace harassment and discrimination based on gender and race and a number of other protected class groups, religion, gender identity, ethnicity, disability by creating an additional incentive for employers to have really clear rules against harassment and discrimination and fairness in insurance benefits availability at their workplaces. An ABC Washington Post poll in 2011 showed that one in four women experienced workplace harassment. A June 2016 EEOC report indicates that workplace harassment is a massive problem, and for people who are bisexual and gay and who are out in the workplace, 35% report workplace harassment. I think many of us in the last year took notice of Gretchen Carlson's public description of workplace sexual harassment and, in fact, assault incidents that she had experienced as a TV news anchor. And I think for a lot of women, that really hit home. Recently, a national jewelry business that has employees in Oregon had hundreds of women come forward and describe workplace sexual harassment and sexual assault incidents at that workplace. And we are aware of high-profile incidents of racial discrimination and other protected class discrimination in workplaces. We have laws against this kind of harassment and discrimination, but as these high-profile incidents show, illegality without more has not always been enough to prevent these kinds of incidents. And so this bill would provide an additional incentive. It would enable the state of Oregon to use its procurement power to provide an additional incentive to prevent workplace harassment and discrimination for businesses that want to do business with the state of Oregon. Specifically, it would require businesses that want to enter into contracts over $150,000 in value with the state of Oregon to certify that they have clear policies that prohibit workplace harassment or discrimination based on any of those protected classes, that they have a clear reporting structure so someone who experiences or witnesses harassment or discrimination of that kind knows who they can go to make it stop, that they have a clear anti-retaliation provision so that people are not afraid to come forward and report harassment or discrimination that they have experienced or they've witnessed, and also that there will be no discrimination in the availability of health insurance benefits for people regardless of gender or gender identity. Right now, we have a chance as a state, even as the Southern Poverty Law Center reports a surge in hate crimes around the country, even as we are shocked and saddened by discriminatory incidents that are happening in our own state, we have a chance to take a stand in support of fair treatment of all workers. As someone who has worked as an employer-side lawyer for many years, I will tell you that once an employee has experienced harassment or discrimination, say in the unwanted sexual contact arena, there is no good option for that person because either they go along with it, which is a demeaning, soul-crushing choice for a person who doesn't want to go along with it. They report it informally and risk informal retaliation in the form of losing a promotion or losing a good schedule or perhaps even losing a job. Or they bring an action in court to contest it. And even then, even if they win, even if they settle, unless they end up with an amount of compensation that kind of accounts for all the rest of their working years, they're in a bad spot because it's not a good place to be in to be a person who's been a whistleblower, who's trying to find another job. So the best we can do is help prevent discrimination at the front end. And what this bill is designed to do is make rules even more clear, create even more incentive for employers to prevent workplace harassment and discrimination so these incidents don't happen in the first place. And I encourage your support of this bill, and I'll turn it over to my good co-chief sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Alonso Leon, and I'm a representative for House District 22, which is Woodburn through the north part of Salem, ensuring that our state government, through its public contracting, lives up to our shared commitment to equity and inclusion is incredibly important to me. I know that all of us as individuals reject discrimination and harassment in our own lives, offices, and businesses, and I believe that we should hold that to businesses with the state that we do work with and that we share those values. HB 3060 requires that contractors hired by the state certify that they have a set policy prohibiting discrimination, sexual harassment, and sexual assault, and the policy must include a process by which instances of discrimination, harassment, and assault will be handled. This means that Oregonians, who we count on to do the business of the state, to build our roads, take care of our most vulnerable populations, and provide needed services, have a guarantee that their employer will be held accountable for sexual harassment, assault, and identity-based discrimination. With the current state of federal affairs, basic rights across the country are under attack. The Trump administration is providing it with, the Trump administration is proving it will not stand up for equality. Messages like that spread to every level of government. According to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Oregon experienced a major increase in charges of discrimination from 2015 to 2016. This influx of discrimination requires actions from the state as well as from every contractor that does business in Oregon. We must stand for Oregonians when others will not, and bills like HB 3060 are necessary to do this. I reject a world where employers can determine your safety at work or discriminate against you based on the color of your skin or your gender and gender identity. Explicit non-discrimination policies are the only way to ensure protection from all Oregonians. Protection for all Oregonians. I stand with groups such as Basic Rights Oregon, who fight every day to protect the rights of every Oregonian, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, and disability, and I urge everyone here to stand up with them as well. It is vital for Oregon to take a stand against discrimination and put into place laws that work to ensure fair and equal treatment in the workplace. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today. When we talk about contractors entering an agreement with the state or whoever, a public employer, for over $150,000, do you know if it specifically is talking about prime contractors, the general contractor, if you will, or is it also applying to subcontractors?
You know, I am going to defer to the representative from the Department of Justice to make sure we get that right. So I'm just going to defer that to the gentleman who's here from DOJ to make sure we answer that correctly.
Okay. I'll give my questions to them as well for other stuff.
Thank you. I think we'll just go to them next, perhaps. Bill Nestle and Josh Bidwell. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd identify yourselves for the record and provide us any testimony you'd like.
Great. Thanks, Chair. Vice Chair Barreto, Vice Chair Bynum, and committee. My name is Josh Bidwell. I'm the legislative assistant for the Attorney General's Office in the Department of Justice. With me today is Bill Nestle, who can help to answer any technical questions you might have. I'll give a brief statement of support and then turn it over to him so we can get moving. First off, I would like to thank Representative Leininger. Sorry, I had her brother as a professor at the University of Oregon Law School. So that is a little odd for me to say Representative Leininger, not Professor Leininger. Representative Leininger, for her leadership on this issue and for coming to us early in this process and working with us and others to get through many drafts when this was just a legislative concept, to get it to a place where we think is a good place, and House Bill 3060 is one that we're happy to be able to support here today. As public contractors are getting money from the public purse, we think it is completely appropriate to expect them to be held to the highest possible standards in contracting, and they should hold themselves in a way that is in alignment with the values of tolerance and diversity that is something that the majority of Oregonians share. For us, the difficult question to answer was, how can we do this and make sure that it's carried out in a way that it won't impose a difficult burden on our agencies and overburden them into policing their contracts in a way that exceeds their capacity? We think House Bill 3060 takes the sensible approach of requiring contractors to demonstrate the existence of preconditions, such as the policy of non-discrimination or a method of reporting discriminatory conduct, as a prerequisite to obtaining a state contract. Because of those sensible requirements, we're happy to support that. And with that brief statement, I'll turn it over to Bill for any questions that you might have.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Bill Nestle. I'm with the Business Transactions Section of the Department of Justice, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have, and I hear that one is coming.
Yeah, I think Representative Hurd and I both share a question about how does this apply, especially in the construction 279C, where your contract or the public contract is actually with the general contractor, or even in goods and services where you have subcontractors. How does this bill play out for subcontractors who are sometimes primarily the ones that are on the job actually doing the work?
Yes. Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, this, number one, it covers only state agency public contracts. Number two, by naming the contractor, this applies exclusively to your prime contractor. That's the only party with whom the state has a contract, as you've observed. So that's the simple answer to that question. It does not affect subcontractors right now.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. So another question I have is, given that there's a lot of times, especially with the larger projects, quite a bit of investment both by the state and the prime contractors to get through the bid process and award the bid, are we, assuming this legislation is passed, are we going to, as the state, vet prime contractors before the bidding begins and say you don't or you do have it, as far as the policy goes and whatnot?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, this one is a little bit rugged in that regard. You'll notice that it says that for contracts over $150,000, the certification must come in with a bidder proposal, or the state agency cannot enter into that contract. So it's looking like, at least for those contracts that are set up, that they must go through an ITB, a bid process, or a request for proposal process, that must come in, the certification must come in ahead of time. The committee does have an option here because of the other provision of possibly could be a situation that could merely forbid state agencies from entering into a contract unless the certification is there before you sign it, which then would change it from being something that makes the contractor responsible in its bid document to a review of whether the bidder or proposer is, did I say responsible? I said responsive the first time. The second time is responsible in the sense that they have come up with a policy and practice.
Final. Thank you.
Final.
Go ahead.
It's on the same point. So thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's say hypothetically goes through the bid process, bid is awarded, but then it is found that the policy is not in place through the prime or general contractor's current policy. Are we going to scrap the bid and start over, or are we going to allow them to have an opportunity to put their policy in place and then move forward before contract is signed?
In this instance, Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, I think that you have to get the certification in as part of your bid package or as part of the proposal package.
That gives me one final follow-up.
Okay.
Thank you. So potentially we could have the low bid, thus the best value bid to the state of Oregon's taxpayers, tossed out because of an oversight to either include that policy in the documentation submitted for the bid or an oversight to create that policy ahead of time. Am I hearing that correctly?
Representative Hurd, that is correct. If that didn't come in with the bid or with the proposal, that's the deadline for getting the whole package in. Hmm. And there is the potential, of course, to, by knocking out about five words, to make this something that the putative awardee, the successful bidder or proposer, could bring to the table at the day of contract signing, along with its insurance proofs and bonds and stuff, and get it done at that time as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. So for somebody who was told something when people were trying to explain this to me, walk me through one more time. What is the actual mechanical process for certification? Is it an affidavit? Is it checking a box? Is it having to showcase the program and bring people in to see the slideshows? What exactly is the certification process?
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, the certification process does not require an affidavit, we think, because this is to be compared with...
We think.
Well, old law used to require an affidavit of tax compliance, and it was changed to a verification or a certification. So I have not advised anybody that an affidavit would be required. It could be used by a state contracting agency. I think that what we envision is a pretty simple process. We have a 7-part with the dash 2 amendments recipe for what must be in the policy and practice of a contractor. And our recommendation, and we've discussed this with the Department of Administrative Services procurement people, would be make them submit a copy of the policy. Then you know they have it.
Thank you. I'd really like to get a couple of people who've traveled here to get up and testify, and we won't finish this bill today, so we'll come back to it.
Okay.
So thank you very much, and maybe you could make yourselves available again.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to have Nancy Hogg, Caden Merrill, and Robin Morris-Collin, please. We've only got about 6 minutes left, so that'd be about 2 minutes apiece.
Okay.
If you could do that.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Hawk. I'm co-executive director of Basic Rights Oregon. I'm here today to ask for your support for this bill, preventing discrimination through public contracting. And I'd also like to say today is our lobby day, and I'm representing 115 Oregonians from across the state who skipped work and school today to be here to speak in favor of this bill. So Basic Rights Oregon works to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Oregonians experience equality. And this legislation is a necessary step in the right direction to ensure that all Oregonians can live free from discrimination. During the last two decades, we've made tremendous progress around LGBTQ equality. We've built a broad coalition of supporters and elected legislators who believe in fairness and equality. Yet despite this work, we know that Oregonians continue to experience discrimination, particularly transgender Oregonians, in healthcare and in employment. And for those unfamiliar, transgender is the term to describe a person whose gender is not the same as the sex they were assigned at birth. Data from the 2015 U.S. Trans Survey reveals significant challenges for transgender individuals. Nearly one-third of transgender people live in poverty, compared to 14% in the U.S. population. And a major contributor to that is the unemployment rate. It is 3 times higher than the employment in the U.S. In the general U.S. population. And 1 in 4 transgender people reported experiencing a problem in the past year with their insurance related to being transgender, such as being denied coverage for life-saving and for routine care because they are transgender. And every Oregonian deserves to work in an environment free of discrimination and harassment. The Oregon legislature has taken steps to ensure that all Oregonians, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability are treated equally under the law. However, Oregon's contracting and procurement statutes have not been updated to reflect these values. And despite our best efforts to end discrimination with the passage of the Oregon Equality Act in 2007, we know discrimination continues, and data from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, in fact, suggest instances of discrimination are on the rise. House Bill 3060 will help level the playing field and reduce discrimination in the workplace. The bill would require prospective contractors, and I won't say more about that, you know what the bill's about, but includes a prohibition on denying benefits to an employee or their dependent based solely on their gender identity. If the employer provides benefits, Oregon's insurance regulators already direct carriers to provide health care services on an equal basis to all Oregonians, regardless of that gender identity. However, not all companies need to comply with this direction because their insurance is based out of state or the company is self-insured. And so what HB 3060 simply states is that if you are doing significant business with the state of Oregon, we expect you to abide by Oregon's values of equality and non-discrimination, as already articulated by Oregon's insurance regulating agency. And more broadly speaking, by requiring employers that seek to obtain contracts from the state of Oregon to certify that they have taken reasonable steps to prevent workplace discrimination, we help Oregon workers and send a clear message that Oregon stands for equality and fair treatment. HB 3060 will prevent discrimination through public contracting, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, and we'll go ahead now. You each have about a minute.
Okay. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Caden Merrill. I am a community member living in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm here today to ask your support for HB 3060, Preventing Discrimination Through Public Contracting. As she was saying, this bill will help limit discrimination against transgender Oregonians like myself, and send a clear message of doing that by that doing business with the state means abiding by our values of non-discrimination. While Oregon is on the forefront of LGBTQ equality nationally, transgender Oregonians still remain among our most vulnerable and misunderstood community members, particularly when it comes to accessing health care and employment. I am one of many transgender Oregonians who have been denied health care because of my gender identity. I am fortunate to have health insurance through my mother's employer, and I recognize that I am still at risk for cervical cancer, which means I need to get an annual pap smear screening. Despite my repeated requests with my previous doctor, she told me I did not need cervical cancer screenings, contrary to the standards of care for a person my age. I continue to ask her. After about 3 years, my doctor acknowledged she did not know how to handle my situation or treat me and recommended that I find a new doctor. I switched doctors and I finally received a pap screening for the first time at age 22. It came back positive for precancerous cells. To prevent the spread of cancer, my physician recommended a hysterectomy, but our insurance provider denied the treatment. Unfortunately, because my mother's insurance was based out of state, it is not regulated directly by Oregon insurance regulators' guidelines that insurers cannot deny coverage based on a person's gender identity. Luckily, in January, my mother changed jobs, and I'm currently working with my new health insurance provider. It's been about 3 months now still to approve the procedure so the precancer cells can be removed. However, life-saving care should not depend on the carrier that you have. HB 3060, as she said, sends a clear message that if you do business with the state of Oregon and provide health benefits, we expect you to provide fair and equal treatment to all your employers and their dependents and not deny coverage based on gender identity.
Thank you.
Thank you for your support.
And, you know, if you'd just like to announce yourself and say whether you support or oppose the bill, that's about all I have time for. If you're more than welcome to come back on Wednesday if you wish.
I will come back.
All right. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3060. We will carry over House Bill 3060, 2671, and 3184. With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Make sure you take
labor.
Make sure you take
that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business.